Arriving at Jerusalem, we bowed down and knelt to thank God for having guided us to that place where we stayed for a month. The time passed most agreeably. Every day we visited the tombs and the funerary monuments. We have wept upon Zion in mourning for its children, shed tears upon the ruins of its palaces and its dwellings, and followed the line of the tombs of the just placed all around it. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 134, Joy and Weeping in Jerusalem. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. In a wonderful sermon, Rabbi Norman Lam once reflected on one of the most curious of culinary Jewish rituals, the dipping of the maror, the bitter herbs, into the sweet substance known as charoset. Maror marks the bitterness of Jewish history. Why then is it dipped into something sweet? There are, of course, technical, Talmudic, and sociological explanations for the development of charoset, but Rabbi Lam expanded on the ritual in a homiletical manner. He reflected, quote, "The maror that we eat at the Seder is more than just a vegetable recalling the hard times inflicted upon our remote ancestors in ancient Egypt. It is the very symbol of human anguish through all the ages, and what we do with it is an expression of the Jewish philosophy of suffering as it issues out of the historical experience of the Jewish people. Consider," he continued, "how astounding is our attitude towards this piece of food and how it speaks volumes to us. We do not weep when we eat it. We take this maror, this morsel of misery, and we recite a bracha, blessing over it, as if to say, thank you, God, for the miserable memory. We then take this bitter herb and dip into charoset, the sweet paste of wine and nuts and fruit. Life, we say, in effect, is neither all bitter nor all sweet." End quote. Rabbi Lam takes this fascinating and eloquent description of the Seder in his own wonderful direction. But this passage in the sermon captures on its own one of the most striking aspects of Jewish life, the ability to join celebration and mourning. Thus today at Jewish weddings, the most joyous of moments, the destruction of the temple, is still mourned. And in the midst of mourning on the 9th of Av, we still recognize that experiencing the miracle of an eternal people, enduring and remembering the temple, is itself a privilege. And we can find the fascinating combination of mourning and joy when the Jews, under the reign of Saladin, were finally able to return to Jerusalem. Over the almost a century of Crusader control, Jews had no real presence in Jerusalem. But that changed with the Muslim conquest of the city. This was done under the leadership of Saladin, who was, to clarify, the nephew of the general Shirku, who served the Damascus ruler Nur al-Din. Following Shirku and Saladin attaining control of Egypt, Saladin then achieved rulership of Damascus after Nur al-Din's death. He set his sights on the Holy Land, engaging the Crusaders first in the Galilee and then conquering Jerusalem in October 1187. He proceeded to remove the Christian elements placed on the Temple Mount, allowing the Church of the Holy Sepulchre to stay, but emphasizing Islam within the city. We will discuss the complexities of multi-faith Jerusalem under Saladin and his successors as we address the Third Crusade and the events that followed in future episodes. For now, let us discuss the enormous implications of Saladin's conquest for the faith and the people long in love with Jerusalem, Judaism, and the Jewish people. As F.E. Peters reflects, quote, "Under the Latins, Jews were not encouraged to live in Jerusalem, so there may have been only one or two families there, as Benjamin of Tudela described. But with the Muslim repossession of the holy city, the Jews were permitted to return. Those who did were probably drawn at first from nearby Ashkelon, then eventually from North Africa, and in 1209 to 1211, 300 Jews arrived from France and England. There were simple pilgrims as well. One of them was the Spanish poet Yehuda al-Harizi," and Peter adds, "his experience is not described in a simple travelogue, but rather under the form of a picaresquely rambling dialogue between two characters, one of them standing for the author on a great variety of subjects, one of them post-Crusader Jerusalem." End quote. I will now read to you from this fascinating reflection about Jerusalem after the conquest of Saladin, written by this Sephardic poet, cited by Peters, giving you the words spoken by the character embodying Yehuda al-Harizi himself. Note in the first passage that we will read, from Yehuda al-Harizi, how genuine the praise is of Saladin, how thankful he is to God for Saladin's advent, and for the fact that the conquest by Saladin had allowed Jews to return. This is what Yehuda al-Harizi writes, quote, "I suppose you have arrived at the end of an exile and from a foreign country," this man said to me. "In effect, yes," I replied. "And how long have the Jews lived anew in this capital, since the Muslims have conquered it? And why was it they did not live here during the Christian domination?" Since those latter accuse us of being deicides, of having crucified their God, they have not left off persecuting and stoning us when they found us here. Tell me the circumstances under which our people were able to return here. God, jealous of the glory of his name and having compassion on his people, decided that the sanctuary would no longer rest in the hands of the sons of Esau, and that the sons of Jacob would not always be excluded from it. Thus, in the year 4950 of creation, God aroused the spirit of the prince of the Ishmaelites, a prudent and courageous man, who came with his entire army, besieged Jerusalem, took it, and had it proclaimed throughout the country that he would receive and accept the entire race of Ephraim, wherever they came from. And so we came from all corners of the world to take up residence here. We now live here in the shadow of peace, and we would be very happy were it not for the tedious internal problems of the various communities and of the spirit of discord which reigns among them, to the point that one could well name this place the Rock of Dissensions. End quote. We must note the words Al-Harizi uses here in this passage regarding Saladin. He says, God aroused the spirit of the prince of the Ishmaelites, a prudent and courageous man. As scholars note, the phrase God aroused the spirit has a specific connotation. It is referring to Cyrus, taken from the last words of the Hebrew Bible, which are, Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord spoken by the mouth of Jeremiah might be accomplished, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and put it also in writing, saying, Thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, All the kingdoms of the earth hath the Lord God of heaven given me, and he hath charged me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Who is there among you of all his people? The Lord his God be with him, and let him go up. That is the conclusion of the Hebrew Bible, the book of Divrei HaYamim, Chronicles. And thus, in speaking of Saladin and referencing the phrase, stirred up the spirit, Al-Harizi is expressing that Jews saw a providential moment when Saladin's conquest of Jerusalem allowed Jews to return to the sacred city. And yet, we note, of course, the difference between Cyrus and Saladin. Cyrus himself not only allowed the exiles to go up to Jerusalem, he also decreed and facilitated the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem. In Saladin's Jerusalem, there was no Jewish temple, and indeed, no real ability for Jews to gather on the Temple Mount. Thus, in the midst of the joy of returning to Jerusalem after Saladin's conquest, there was also for Jews mourning for the destruction of the Jewish Jerusalem and the Jewish temple that had been. Thus, in this same work, Yehuda Al-Harizi writes as follows about the Jewish return to Jerusalem, quote, Arriving at Jerusalem, we bowed down and knelt to thank God for having guided us to that place where we stayed for a month. The time passed most agreeably. Every day we visited the tombs and the funerary monuments. We have wept upon Zion in mourning for its children, shed tears upon the ruins of its palaces and its dwellings, and followed the line of the tombs of the just placed all around it. End quote. Note the striking combination of emotions, if you will, maror and charoset in one small passage. Yehuda Al-Harizi describes how excited the Jews were to return to Jerusalem. But of course, part of what they do in Jerusalem is weep for the ruins of the Jewish city. Indeed, they describe their time in Jerusalem, including the time spent weeping and mourning, as time passed most agreeably. Joy and mourning for these Jews in Jerusalem, in other words, went hand in hand. And indeed, part of their joy was found in the opportunity to and the privilege of finally entering Jerusalem to mourn for the temple. These two emotions are then made manifest as well in Yehuda Al-Harizi's description of his ascent to the Mount of Olives, where he describes how Jews seized the opportunity to pray atop that mount toward the Temple Mount, but also describing their sadness over the fact that the site of the Holy of Holies had served over the past many centuries as a Muslim shrine, a Christian church, and a Muslim shrine again, with only Jews not being allowed to worship on that site as they believed they were called to serve. Thus, Yehuda Al-Harizi gives us joy at the opportunity to return to Jerusalem, sadness at the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, and also joy even at the freedom to be sad about the destruction at the site of the destruction itself. For even the opportunity to mourn in Jerusalem was denied to Jews in a real way during the Crusader period, and that was not the only time this opportunity was denied to Jews. Rarely discussed today is the fact that under Jordan from 1948 to 1967, the old city of Jerusalem had no Judaism in it, and Jews were not allowed to enter the old city, even to mourn near the Temple Mount, even to weep for the destruction of the temple. In contrast to other moments in Jerusalem's history, when Jews would gain access to the Temple Mount, or at least to a site near it, on the 9th of Av itself in order to mourn, between 1948 and 1967, even that was denied to Jewish mourners for the temple. This occurred during the 20th century. The ability to combine happiness and joy, along with a recognition of the destruction, as well as with a faith in a full redemption that is ultimately to come, is profoundly Judaic. In a wonderful essay about Judaism and art, the writer Sarah Ridner reflected on the concept of Zecher L'Churban, remembrances in mourning for the temple, writing that, quote, "There are a variety of customs that are associated with Zecher L'Churban, some of them more widely observed than others. For example, a glass is shattered under a Jewish wedding canopy. Women are instructed not to wear all of their fine jewelry at any one time. And in some circles, even listening to music is curtailed. The pervasiveness of these customs," she continues, "does not reflect a sense of nihilism or a cult of mourning. Rather, the sages say that whoever mourns over Jerusalem will merit to see its joy. Counterintuitively, reminding ourselves of our incompleteness specifically points to the promise of an eventual restoration," end quote. This is brilliantly written. For Judaism, destruction is a source of sadness, but also in the midst of mourning, Jews are inspired toward hope and faith in full restoration. The ability to join mourning and joy is paralleled, as Rabbi Lam said, in the rituals of the Seder. And so I end today's talk with Rabbi Lam's words, which apply to life in general. Rabbi Lam said, quote, "A people that dips maror into charoset and makes a bracha over it is never defeated by fate or by foe. A folk that can find the mellow in a morsel of misery can drive away the darkness with its own light, the outer sorrow with the inner joy," end quote. This is Meir Soloveitchik. Looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.